Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Guardian.
I'm Lucy Lamble. Welcome to this edition of the Global Development Podcast, which looks back at 2017, a year that's seen some critical changes in developing countries.
The president, it's no secret, has made it very clear that he's a pro-life president. The reinstatement of this policy and ensures that we're standing up not just for life, but for also taxpayer funds that are being spent overseas to perform an action that is contrary to the values of this president.
In South Sudan, almost 2 million people are on the brink of starvation from the effects of drought and civil war.
I'm just going to bring you some breaking news now saying that President Robert Mugabe has resigned and is accused of allowing his wife to usurp constitutional power by trying to position her as his successor.
Joining me to take a look at some of the main stories affecting millions around the planet are, down the line, Jason Burke, Africa correspondent for The Guardian, reporting from across the continent. And in the studio, Liz Ford, Deputy Editor for Global Development. The year started with the arrival of President Trump on the international stage. And of course, with him came the global gag, a move that withdrew a great deal of US funding for family planning across the world. Liz, family planning is such a vexed subject where policy seems to take an abrupt 180-degree turn depending on whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans in office. Could you recap exactly how the global gag works? And what did Trump's election mean for women and families around the world?
It's had a pretty devastating effect for women. The global gag rule, which is officially known as the Mexico City policy, basically cuts out funding, US funding, for any foreign organization that's doing anything to do with abortion. So that could be just having a leaflet in your center, or it could be full on actually carrying out abortions. So it cuts all funding. And it comes in with the Republicans, and then the Democrats rescind this Mexico City policy. It's brought in under Reagan. And every time that it's brought in, there's a spike in unsafe abortions, maternal deaths. It's pretty devastating. What makes this one particularly nasty is the fact that it's been extended. So not only does it cover family planning funding, it actually covers all global health assistance from the US. So the Center for Health and Gender Equity, which is based in Washington, says that at least 1,200 foreign NGOs will be impacted by the global gag rule.
That's a huge number.
Yeah, it is. And I think at the moment people are still in shock about it, reading from it and still trying to calculate what it actually means. I mean, for example, the International Planned Parenthood Federation, which has refused to sign up to the global gag, at the time said that they were going to be losing millions. Their member associations will be losing millions of dollars. And, you know, in Uganda, for example, the member association that I visited, they're looking at funding being cut very soon, so programs will have to end in advance. In Mozambique, one organization has lost sort of 2/3 of its funding just like that because they rely on the US. So this is going to be pretty tricky.
And as much as you're worried, obviously, about maternal mortality rates going up, the other great concern often is adolescents, isn't it? That they're actually getting basic information about their sexual and reproductive health.
Yes, and that's, as you say, that's a very vexed issue when it comes to young people. Because it covers such a wide remit, I think teenagers have the highest HIV infection rates in parts of Africa, but they're not going to find that they can get the services that they need. This organisation in Mozambique, for example, reaches out to young people with HIV care, and if their funding's cut, their programmes will be cut, and this could have, you know, a devastating effect on young people in the region.
And the UN body responsible for family planning had a double hit, didn't it?
So, yes. So after the global gag, the Trump administration decided to end funding for the UNFPA, which is the UN Population Fund, and that's under the Kemp-Kasten Amendment. And that basically forbids foreign aid to organisations that are believed to be involved in coercive abortion or involuntary sterilisation, which is something that the UNFPA denies. And in fact, the memo that was announcing the move actually stated there was no evidence that the UNFPA actually engages in this. So it just, again, feels like this is what you do when you're a Republican in power. You kind of flick all these sort of switches. And again, that means, I think last year, more than $60 million was paid to the UNFPA from the US. So again, that's going to have big consequence for them.
But other countries, other donor countries, did their own response, this She Decides movement. How's that evolving?
So within days of Trump reinstating the global gag in January, Lilian Ploumen, who's the Dutch minister, came in and said, right, we're going to fill the gap. And so the movement, the She Decides movement, emerged from that, which is basically to campaign to find money to give to UNFPA, to Mary Stopes, to IPPF. They had a pledging conference in March, which raised about $100 million. And by the end of the year, they're expecting it to be about $500 million. And there's a big push globally. They've got global ambassadors on board. It's quite a phenomenal kind of movement that's kind of sparked this kind of effort. But there's still a huge gap. I mean, the impact of this, you're looking at sort of like $8.8 billion of funding that needs to be found. So there are like lots of drops of the ocean, but actually it's kind of what She Decides, I think, has done as well, is has sort of rejuvenated the women's rights organisations.
In July in London, there was this second big family planning summit. What was the mood like there?
It was quite defiant, but it was kind of worried. There was definitely a concern amongst people there because the US is the biggest bilateral funder for family planning contraceptives. So, and Melinda Gates came out and just sort of said, you know, Trump is worrying, and that kind of got a lot of the headlines. But I think there are concerns because the FP 2020 project, which was launched in 2012 with the idea to give like 120 million more women and girls access to contraceptive in the key countries, 69 key countries, is off track. Halfway in, they've only sort of reached 30 million women and girls. So there's a massive push that needs to happen, and money needs to come with that. So there are concerns about that this is just not going to be reached.
Sobering, and definitely something for us to be watching in the coming year. Well, thank you very much. It wasn't just Trump who was inaugurated in January, of course, this year. It was a big year for elections all over the world and big changes in governance too. Jason, we've been seeing these long-staying and increasingly unpopular leaders actually moving on out this year in some cases. So I'm referring, of course, to Gambia, there's Zimbabwe, you know, which effectively bookended the year. And of course, there's been this really resilient fight for democracy, very evident on the streets in Kenya. Shall we start with Gambia? A big change there.
Yeah, I mean, Yahya Jammeh had been in power for 22 years, and I was talking to people are very well informed, who are watching Gambia before the elections and talking to them about what might come up and who was going to win and who wasn't and what the opposition was going to do. And there was absolutely no sense that election was going to see the end of Jammeh's rule. And it did. I mean, it didn't in a particularly straightforward way. It involved quite a lot of eventual saber rattling by the Senegalese and a lot of pressure from other West African states. But they got there in the end, and Jammeh is off in Equatorial Guinea, I think, last reported attending a farm. Quite what he's doing at a farm.
Quite change of scene.
Or quite what he's doing with his very large collection of luxury vehicles, which he brought out with him as well on his farm, I'm not sure. But the point is that, you know, particularly I think in West Africa, the sense is that worked, that there were the powers came together, Nigeria, Liberia, other powers came together and basically said, we will not stand for this. This is not how we do things in West Africa. And that is a pretty positive. In the east and in the south of the continent, it's, as you say, rather different. I mean, Mugabe did go, which is a good thing, but in a rather troubling way, in a coup that dared not speak its name. And there are still very worrying question marks over not just that process, but what that process has left. I mean, this was basically not a kind of democratic uprising by the people, although on the streets of Harare there was an awful lot of rejoicing and enthusiasm for reform. It was basically ZANU-PF, the ruling party, and Mugabe's vehicle until now, cleaning its own house effectively and making sure that it was well placed to keep power going forward, because the succession of Mugabe's second wife, Grace, would have threatened that continued rule. So it was positive in some senses, but still some very concerning aspects. And as for Kenya, well, that kind of depends on where you stand in a very polarized country. We had two elections. We had a rerun of the first election, the second one forced by what appeared to be a landmark Supreme Court ruling, the first time on the continent that a judicial decision had overturned an election, particularly by an incumbent, that's Uhuru Kenyatta, seeking a second five-year term. In the end, he got it. Nobody's questioning it now. The opposition is in some disarray, and so is the Supreme Court, which has kind of been kicked back into its box by the political executive, the politicians. Neither election saw the kind of violence that some people have been predicting, a return to 2007-2008, when there was 1,000 people dead and massive displacement. But people did die, 60-70 people died. So again, it's a mixed picture. I mean, in some ways, you could say that this is all part of Kenya establishing itself as a mature democracy. In other ways, you could see it as quite threatening to democracy, and analysts are divided on which way we should view it.
Meanwhile, the citizens in DR Congo are still awaiting elections. No sign yet that President Kabila is ready to hand over, and a pretty tough humanitarian situation in areas like Kasai at the moment.
Yeah, the overall situation in DRC is extremely worrying. There is limited evidence, I think it's fair to say, that Joseph Kabila has any intention of handing over power, and seems to think that his strategy is strategy to just continually push back elections and hope that something's going to turn up which will allow him to stand for third term or somehow otherwise cement his and his clique's hold on power will just turn up. As he does so, and partly because he's doing so, there is a very significant deterioration in the humanitarian situation and, of course, the security situation, the two going hand in hand, across much of the country, but particularly in the Kasai provinces, in the central south and in the east, increasingly, where last week we had 15 UN peacekeepers killed in an attack by a local militia. So things are looking very bad. All three axes, if you like, the security, the political and the humanitarian, all go together. As there is a significant deterioration in the political front, that has clear ramifications across the other elements too, and is causing an awful lot of very significant need among very vulnerable populations.
Let's continue with that theme of humanitarian crises, which unfortunately are a bit of a benchmark of the year. I mean, one indication of that is the fact that the Disasters and Emergency Committee actually had three concurrent appeals at one point, with Yemen starting earlier in the year, the crisis in East Africa, and then most recently for the Rohingya arriving in southern Bangladesh from Myanmar. And of course, we had a tough hurricane season in the Caribbean, particularly devastating and leading to all kinds of debates about development and humanitarian funding. Liz, what's your impression of the year? It's really hard to compare them, but has this been significantly worse than any other years? Or
It's very difficult to compare them. I don't know whether it feels a bit more in your face in a way. Generally, the whole of the year, certainly from a women's rights point of view, has been completely clouded by Trump and everything else. So it's almost like everything the man does or doesn't do makes everything worse. So any kind of disaster, it's made worse because perhaps sort of how he reacts to certain crises on his own doorstep, hurricanes in Puerto Rico, for example, that's kind of quite shocking how he's reacting to that. So in a way, everything feels quite bad. But the UK government has come under fire for how it failed to do enough in a timely way when it comes to Hurricane Irma. It was sort of bound by OECD rules around aid, which means that funding can only go to poorer countries, and the Turks and Caicos, you know, does not cut it as one of those. But people are still in need. So it's kind of, you know, balancing the two things up. And it's definitely an example that will go into the continued talks about the changes to the rules around aid. Definitely.
It's because there was nothing actually stopping Britain being generous in its response to the current, obviously logistical challenges as ever. But it was really a debate about technically how things were arranged on a budget sheet, wasn't it? Would it count towards the 0.7 under the OECD official development assistance rules?
Yes, and I think, and the UK government is very keen on making sure, I mean, it's legislated that we do meet the 0.7%. So there's lots of things that go on, and it's almost like pushing papers around to make everything fit in the right sort of boxes. And the UK did give money, they did support, they sent as much as they could or were allowed to do. So they would sort of say that they did act in a good way.
And of course, since then, we have a new Secretary of State for development.
We do indeed. That sort of came a little bit left field with Priti Patel resigning and Penny Mordaunt coming in. So it's sort of she's came out and made sort of big announcements about focusing on disabilities, which is what Priti Patel had started and actually was already floating around at DFID before that. So it'd be really interesting to see how things move under her, definitely.
Jason, you've been covering some of the humanitarian tragedies unfurling on the continent. You visited both South Sudan and Somalia this year at the peak of the hunger crisis. What was the situation like there? Let's start with Somalia.
When I got to Somalia, I think that was April, the main problem was cholera, which obviously goes very often with hunger. It was killing a large number of kids, particularly. Unfortunately, we don't know how many because a lot of them are in areas beyond where we can get any decent information and where the humanitarian agencies can get to. But I mean, that was part of a much broader issue. Obviously, you had the drought. We also have an upsurge in insecurity with more violence. The insurgency of the Al-Shabaab Islamist organization is still very tenacious and strong. So you had that typical situation with again, the security, the political, there was an election earlier in the year, and the humanitarian all playing together to create a perfect storm, if you like. And it was the only good thing that came out of it, if you like, the only positive was that there was a very significant international effort which did mitigate some of the worst effects of the drought and the incipient famine. So there was a good response from the international community which made things at least better than it would have been otherwise. It was still pretty terrible, but you didn't see a return to the kind of numbers of dead or similar levels of need that there'd been in the 2011 famine.
Which is great to hear that you could see some impact.
Yeah, and there was a genuine mobilisation. The UN were doing a lot of work. The British were involved. I mean, there were all sorts of people who were, and increasingly actually the Turks and other powers acting unilaterally or bilaterally quite often. But still, there was a lot going on, and that did have an impact. I mean, that was quite a successful intervention in many ways, though clearly there's still great need, and the numbers of displaced are very high, over a million. Still, it could have been much worse, but for that relatively early intervention. South Sudan, sadly, it's very difficult to be positive about that at all.
It is. Again, when we're talking numbers of displaced people, South Sudan is really something.
Absolutely. And not just that. I mean, it just appears utterly intractable. The political situation is dire. The security situation is getting worse and worse as there is a snowballing in anarchy, insecurity, disorder, ethnic violence, traditional clashes between all sorts of different groups, new groups turning up, old groups fading away. I mean, it's extremely complicated situation in which civilians are bearing the greatest burden. And there is, I think, most worryingly, very little way you can see of it getting much better, at least in the short term. So I think South Sudan, and certainly from a personal point of view, South Sudan was a deeply, deeply saddening experience as a reporter. And there have been some pretty nasty experiences generally in terms of what you're seeing. It has seen a lot of very tragic things this year, but South Sudan was particularly depressing.
Jason, you're based in Johannesburg. We've just had the ANC conference. Cyril Ramaphosa is to be the new party leader. But looking back, it's been a lively year for South Africa.
No, it has been a particularly tumultuous year. The South African economy is in a pretty shaky state. A lot of institutions have been undermined in recent years, particularly in the security area. But others have shown themselves to be very strong. So the media is still pretty strong. The judiciary particularly is very strong. So going forward in 2018, I think we're going to see very, very interesting developments as the ruling ANC look to forthcoming elections in 2019. Will they go down a populist strategy? Will they look to major reforms that would please international investors? I mean, we just don't know. So it's a really critical moment for South Africa. It's a critical moment from an economic perspective, from a political perspective, and in some ways from a cultural perspective too. And what sort of South Africa is going to be there in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, 20 years' time?
Liz, reasons to be positive. It's been a tough year for women in developing countries, but women do seem to be working together to try and find solutions. Could we be at a tipping point?
I think we could be. I was speaking to Robin Gorner from She Decides quite recently, and she was saying that basically the shock of Trump's election and the expansive reach of the global gag rule has galvanised action this year. She was sort of saying, if things get so bad, you get a strong reaction, and if you push us this hard, women will rise up, and that's exactly what they've been doing this year, and I think that can only be a good thing.
So onward and upwards.
Absolutely.
Well, that's it for this week. A huge thanks to Jason and Liz for joining us. Please subscribe and review on all your favourite podcatchers and join the discussion on Twitter. Just search Guardian Podcasts. If you want to get in touch, it's podcasts@theguardian.com. Till next time, I've been Lucy Lamble. The producers were Gabriella Jones and Rowan Slaney. And this was the Global Development Podcast. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.